This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Justice and Peace. We shall close with the sports roundup. I am Johnny Baptist Tumusime. Pope Francis has asked the editor-in-chief of an Italian newspaper, Luciano Fontana, to relaunch and amplify his appeal for peace and disarmament. The request is contained in a letter the Holy Father wrote to Mr. Fontana from Gemelli Hospital. In response to the letter the editor had written to him, expressing his solidarity and closeness with him during his illness. Mr. Fontana heads an Italian daily known as Corriere della Sera, translated in English as the Evening Messenger. Pope Francis thanked him for the words of closeness in this moment of his illness, but noted that war appears even more absurd. He encouraged him and all those who dedicate their work and intelligence to informing through communications tools that now connect our world in real time to feel the full importance of words. He said words are not just words, they are facts that shape human environments. They can connect or divide, serve the truth, or used for other ends. He said words should be used for the meaning they carry. War, he explained, only devastates communities and the environment without offering solutions to conflicts. He lamented about the failures of diplomacy and underlined that it and international organizations are in need of a new life and credibility. Religions, he added, can draw from the spirituality of peoples to rekindle the desire for fraternity and justice, the hope for peace. All this requires commitment, work, silence, and words. Let us feel united in these efforts, he said, which heavenly grace will continue to inspire and accompany. In a related development, the Holy See Press Office issued a brief statement on Monday evening saying that Pope Francis's health was stable with slight improvements. The Pope continues to do the therapies recommended by his doctors. Addressing concerns about the Pope's swollen hand that was visible in a photo released on Sunday when he was praying in the hospital church, the doctors said decreased mobility was the cause for the swelling, but that it had already improved. The next medical bulletin about the Pope's health will be released on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the rosary prayer for health of Pope Francis for Tuesday will be led by the Holy See's major penitentiary, Cardinal Angelo De Donatis. The prayer will take place in St. Peter's Square here in the Vatican at 18:30 GMT. The second National Education Forum in Ghana ended at the weekend with a call to heads of Catholic institutions of learning to strengthen the Catholic identity in their respective schools. The forum was hosted by the Catholic Diocese of Koforiduam and started on 10th March and ended on Saturday, March 15th. It was guided by the theme Catholic Education for Integral Development, Shaping a Resilient and Inclusive Ghana. The event was attended by teachers, religious leaders, parents, sponsors, students, and state representatives. In his address, the president of the Ghana Catholic Bishops' Conference, the Right Reverend Matthew Kwasi Jamfi, explained that education is a heavy task that requires collective effort and thus the need for a proper partnership with well-defined roles to ensure effective delivery in the country. He emphasized the need to strengthen the Catholic identity in Catholic schools at all levels by teaching Catholic doctrine, building chapels, increasing the presence of priests and consecrated persons, and by appointing chaplains to the schools. Bishop Jamfi called upon the Ghanaian government to have a permanent representation for the Catholic Church at the Ministerial Advisory Board of Education and the Ghana Education Council, in recognition of the Church as the second largest provider of education in the country. He also called for more investment in technical and vocational education and training, because this will help to reduce unemployment and also to enhance technological improvement in the country. Officials of the Association of Member Episcopal Conferences of Eastern Africa, AMESEA, and officials of the Association of Consecrated Women in Eastern and Central Africa completed a 3-day workshop aimed at fostering unity, among other things, last week. The event was held in the Tanzanian city of Arusha and highlighted the importance of prayer and reflection, interactive team activities, commitment to strengthen partnership, and teamwork. The provincial superior of the Comboni North America province, Father Rufino Ezama, has called upon Catholic dioceses in Africa to start projects that will sustain their work of evangelization because financial help from abroad has dwindled. Father Ezama, a Ugandan national, was speaking at the weekend from the U.S. city of Cincinnati. He said for many years, missionaries who evangelized Africa came from Europe, and whenever there were material needs, they would ask their relatives and friends to help. But today, vocations to the priesthood and to religious life in Europe have reduced drastically, and Africa is being evangelized by Africans themselves, many of whom come from humble financial backgrounds. He emphasized that many Catholic dioceses in Africa have resources such as land, which can be used to generate funds to run the activities of the church without depending so much on external sources. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
The M23 rebels who are fighting the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo announced on Monday evening that they had withdrawn from peace talks with the government that had been scheduled to take place on Tuesday, March 18th in the Angolan capital, Luanda. A statement released by rebel groups said the sanctions announced by the European Union on Monday against some of their leaders had become an obstacle to their participation in the direct talks that would have been mediated by Angola President João Lourenço. The sanctions targeted 5 senior leaders of the M23, including the movement's leader Bertrand Bisimwa, who were accused of masterminding instability and insecurity in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebels accused the Congolese government of persecuting certain ethnic groups in the country. The Congolese government said it would send its delegate to Luanda despite the withdrawal of M23 from the talks. Meanwhile, ministers from the East African Community and the Southern African Development Community met on Monday in Harare, Zimbabwe, and discussed ways of resolving the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Reports from South Sudan say 21 people, including a local paramount chief, were killed on Monday in an airstrike on a village in Nasir County in Upper Nile State. The bombing came just weeks after intense clashes between government forces and the White Army militia. South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makuei confirmed that the Air Force had bombed Nasir. Witnesses had accused both the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and Uganda People's Defense Forces of targeting residential areas. Uganda sent special forces to South Sudan last week to help the government fight off insurgents. The leader of its contingent had earlier warned the White Army militia to surrender or face attack. The violence has raised fears of a return to the civil war. The government has accused First Vice President Riek Machar's party of links to the White Army, a claim his party denies. Health officials in Zimbabwe say the country is experiencing a sharp rise in non-communicable diseases such as hypertension, diabetes, and cardiovascular diseases, which are affecting especially young people under 40 years of age. A key driver of this trend is a shift in diet, with many Zimbabweans consuming more processed and ultra-processed foods while leading sedentary lifestyles. Statistics show that non-communicable diseases account for over 40% of deaths in the country, while 44% of disability-adjusted life years lost before age 40. Zimbabwe is among 47 African countries that are heavily burdened with non-communicable diseases.
And now, our feature, Justice and Peace. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Privacy, Dr. Anna Bryan Nogrey, presented a report last week to the United Nations Human Rights Council about neurotechnologies and the challenges they pose to some fundamental human rights. Neurotechnology refers to electronic methods that are used to monitor the nervous system and its activities, such as information processing, human reactions, and control of thoughts. This technology is already being used in the field of medicine to offer treatment for some diseases such as Parkinson's and other devastating illnesses. Dr. Nogrey told the Human Rights Council in Geneva last Wednesday that as neurotechnologies evolve, they pose ethical and legal challenges to the right to privacy.
These technologies, which can record, decode, and even modify brain activity, have extraordinary potential in medicine, communication, and research. However, they also introduce unprecedented risks, including the unauthorized access, manipulation, and misuse of what should remain our most private domain, our thoughts and our mental processes. The rapid advancement of neurotechnologies necessitates an urgent regulatory response. International human rights bodies, including the UN Human Rights Council, have recognized both the opportunities and threats posed by these innovations.
The report addresses specific risks posed by neurotechnologies and proposes key principles to regulate and safeguard fundamental rights. Dr. Nogrey again.
Neurodata, information derived directly from the nervous system, constitutes highly sensitive personal data. Unlike other forms of personal information, neurodata can reveal not only an individual's identity, but also their thoughts, emotions, and cognitive patterns. This unique sensitivity requires enhanced legal and ethical protections. My report highlights both the benefits and the risks of neurotechnologies. On the one hand, they offer groundbreaking solutions for treating neurological disorders, improving cognitive functions, and expanding human capabilities. On the other hand, they raise serious concerns, including the following. First, we are concerned with mental privacy violations. Neurotechnology have the capacity to decode brain activity, allowing access to an individual's most intimate thoughts and emotions. Without proper safeguards, this could lead to unauthorized monitoring or even coercion. Governments, corporations, or malicious actors could exploit this access to influence personal decisions, behaviors, and ideologies, fundamentally eroding personal autonomy and mental integrity. Second, we are concerned with manipulation and autonomy concerns. The ability to directly alter neural activity introduces the risk of cognitive manipulation. Technologies capable of stimulating certain neural patterns might be used to artificially shape opinions, emotions, or even memories, raising profound ethical concerns. If left unregulated Individuals could lose the ability to make independent decisions, undermining the core principle of free will. Third, we are concerned with discrimination risks. The processing of neurodata opens the door to a new form of discrimination, which we can call neurodiscrimination. Employers, insurers, and institutions may misuse neurodata to assess cognitive abilities, emotional states, or predispositions, leading to biased hiring processes, unequal access to services, or unjustified exclusion from opportunities. This could deepen existing social inequalities and create a new class of marginalized individuals based on their neural characteristics. We're concerned also with security vulnerabilities. Number four, neurotechnologies that connect brain activity to digital networks pose significant security, cybersecurity risks. Such technologies could enable unauthorized access to private thoughts, expose individuals to identity theft, or even allow external actors to influence neural activity remotely. This makes neurotechnologies a potential target for cyber attacks that could compromise both individual privacy and public security. Given these challenges, it is imperative to establish neuro rights, a new category of human rights, aimed at protecting dignity and autonomy of individuals in the face of these emerging technologies.
Neurotechnologies, according to Dr. Nogre, are developing very fast and extending beyond the medical field to encompass consumer, workplace, education, criminal justice, and military applications. Because their use raises serious human rights concerns, the report proposes five fundamental neural rights that must be respected by the operators of these technologies.
The first one is mental privacy, protection against unauthorized access to neural data. The second, personal identity, safeguarding the integrity of an individual's cognitive and emotional self. The third, free will, ensuring that individuals remain in full control of their thoughts and decisions. The fourth, non-discrimination, preventing biases in access to and use of neurotechnologies. And the fifth and last is equitable access, guaranteeing that all individuals, regardless of socioeconomic status, benefit from neurotechnological advancements.
Dr. Nogre told the Human Rights Council that while these technologies have become beneficial, the privacy of our minds must be taken as one of our top priorities. Her office's report makes also recommendations with regard to these new technologies.
To address these concerns, my report urges first to develop regulatory frameworks. National and international laws must govern the use of neurotechnologies to ensure they respect human rights. This includes defining clear guidelines on how neurodata should be collected, processed, and stored. It is essential that legal instruments explicitly prohibit unauthorized use of neurotechnologies for surveillance, coercion, or any activity that compromises mental privacy and individual autonomy. Second, recommendation, incorporate core privacy principles. Legal instruments should include protections for mental privacy, informed consent, and the ethical use of neurodata. A key component of this is requiring explicit, informed, and revocable consent for the collection and use of neurodata. Additionally, neurotechnologies must be developed with a privacy-by-design approach to ensure data protection is integrated from the outset rather than being an afterthought. Third recommendation, enhance oversight and accountability. Governments and regulatory bodies must monitor the development and deployment of neurotechnologies to prevent abuses. Independent supervisory authorities should be established to review neurotechnology applications, ensuring compliance with human rights principles. Also, mechanisms for redress and accountability must be accessible to individuals whose neurodata has been misused, including legal pathways for addressing violations. Fourth, and last recommendation, promote public awareness and ethical discourse. Education and transparent discussions about neurotechnologies will empower individuals to make informed decisions about their use. Raising awareness about the risks and benefits of neurotechnologies should be a priority, ensuring that both policymakers and the public understand the implications of these advancements. Ethical discussions should also include multidisciplinary input, drawing from neuroscience, law, ethics, and human rights to create comprehensive and balanced regulatory frameworks.
Dr. Anna Brian Nogre, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Privacy, speaking there last Wednesday at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva. And that was Justice and Peace for this week.
This is a sports roundup and welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Nigeria, Cameroon, Zambia and Guinea secured their spots in the third and final round of qualifiers for the 2025 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup, joining Ivory Coast after their respective fixtures and victories on Saturday 14th March. While Nigeria sealed their qualification with a 2-0 victory over South Africa in Ikene, bringing the aggregate score to 5-1, Guinea advanced to the next round after defeating Sierra Leone 2-1 in the second leg of the second round. Cameroon, meantime, took a decisive step toward the final round of qualifications with a 1-0 win over Ethiopia, and Zambia qualified for the third round of qualifications with a 1-0 win over Tanzania. This success, coupled with a comprehensive 4-0 win on aggregate, allows the COSAFA Under-17 champions to continue their journey. Zambia will face the winner of the match between Benin and Democratic Republic of Congo in the next round. Football experts say that coach Tom Santhier hopes to write history with Mali as he aims to revive the nation's hopes of reaching the 2026 FIFA World Cup. The Eagles, who have never appeared at the tournament, are currently fourth in Group I, 4 points behind both leaders Comoros and second-placed Ghana after 4 rounds of the 10-game qualifying campaign. Only the group winners are assured of qualification, but Santhier, who took charge last August after a 6-month stint in charge of the Philippines, has an immediate chance to improve fortunes as his side take on Comoros in Moroni on 20th March before another away match 4 days later against a Central African Republic team now under the guidance of Cameroon legend Rigobert Song. A talented Mali side came close to qualifying for the 2022 World Cup but lost to Tunisia 1-0 on aggregate in a playoff. And that was the only goal the Eagles conceded over what was an 8-game campaign for the finals in Qatar. Having replaced Eric Schell, Santhier has already overseen an unbeaten qualifying campaign for the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations, which begins in December in Morocco. Mali comfortably won their group ahead of Mozambique, dropping just 4 points across 6 games. After this month's fixtures, the final 4 group games will be split across September and October. The 4 best-ranked second-placed sides across all 10 groups will then enter playoffs, which will provide one African team with a final chance to book a spot at the 2026 World Cup in Canada, Mexico, and the United States of America, through an intercontinental qualifier. And as Africa prepares for the upcoming big events in football, there is a realization of the fact that there is a new era for the continent's national teams, with African coaches on the rise. For decades, African football was shaped by foreign coaches, primarily from Europe. National federations believed then that success required experienced foreign managers, often from France, Germany, Portugal or the Netherlands. African coaches were seen as assistants, their roles limited to backroom duties. But the last decade has seen a remarkable transformation with a new wave of African coaches, not just filling vacancies but are actually winning. For the third straight Total Energies Confederation of African Football, AFCON, an African coach led his country to continental success. Take, for instance, MS4, who guided Ivory Coast to 2023 Total Energies Confederation of African Football Cup of Nations glory on home soil last year. Four followed in the footsteps of Aliye Cheze, who won with Senegal in 2022, and Jamel Beomadi, who steered Algeria to victory in 2019. The general feeling now is that the dominance of African coaches at the highest level is no longer a coincidence, but rather a growing trend. Actually, the fact is that out of 54 African national teams, about 31 are currently coached by African managers, marking a dramatic shift from the past when European tacticians dominated the dugouts. As we may already know, Patrice Motsepe was confirmed last week on Wednesday as president of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, extending his leadership of African football for another 4 years. The re-election of the 63-year-old South African businessman took place in Cairo during the 14th General Assembly of the Confederation of African Football. The African football body organizes 13 competitions on the continent, including the Champions League, the Women's Africa Cup of Nations, and the Men's Cup of Nations. Motsepe was first elected to lead the 54 continental football federations in March 2021. During the assembly on Wednesday, Samuel Eto'o, the former Cameroon international, won a place on the CAF Executive Committee. The continent's representatives for the FIFA Council were also elected during the assembly. And on that note, we come to the end of today's edition of our Sports Roundup. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyanita Godfrey Kampamba.
You have been listening to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tumusime. In your next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature Health and Healing and our segment on the Holy Year 2025. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.